Good morning. It's good to see so many of you here. The question is, I guess I'll just put it to you. What do the enlightened want? What would you say to that? Any takers on that? We're all very much concerned with our own wants, aren't we? What do we want? What do the enlightened want? Well, of course, whatever we say, it's kind of dead. It's only dead, of course, if we hang on to it, if we try to grasp it. And that is generally our problem. And what the enlightened want, of course, whatever I say, they'll kill it right there. But, what the awakened want is to be awake. What the awakened need is to be awake. If we think we need something here, and then we also want something here, if we can separate these things out, if there are many different items that we can begin to list in terms of our needs and wants, then this is a delusion. But to just be awake is enough. Generally, we don't think so because we're so caught up with this or that, the immediate things that we find around us that we either want or we don't want, still wanting. Well, there's an interesting story. I've used this at times in the Eightfold Noble Path class. A story of Isan and his student Gyosan. And Gyosan came up to Isan and he said, when the 10,000 things come up to you, what should you do? And Isan said, green is not yellow. Long is not short. Each thing has its own. Why should I interfere? Green is not yellow. Long is not short. Each thing has its own. Why should I interfere? But we think we have to interfere. Very often, this is in our thinking, that we have to do something. We have to be something. We have to arrange something. And then maybe if we can make the right arrangement, then everything will be okay. But this is like coming up with an answer. We don't recognize that the answer, whatever the answer is going to be, is a frozen thing here. As Glassman pointed out last night, it's dead. It's not alive. And the reality that we are living is very much alive. It's completely alive. It's a thoroughgoing change in flux and flow. There's nothing in it that we can grasp. Nothing we can take hold of. Nothing lasts. But in not understanding this, in feeling some dissatisfaction, we reach for something. We carry on in our life as if somehow it could be arranged properly so that we could be happy. We can get what we want. We can be satisfied in some way. But no matter what you would put there, if you just look at that very carefully, you will see the dissatisfaction woven right into that very situation. Even to supply yourself with an answer. We don't need an answer. An answer will just be something conceptualized. Something frozen, something separated from reality, and something separated from you. At best, you can just cling to that, but now you're left once again with wanting, needing something to sustain you in some way. This is all very dissatisfying. And once again, it leads us to thinking some more about what it is that we need to fix up this situation. We don't realize that if we didn't keep reaching in this way, we would notice that the situation is perfectly fine and the way it is. The reason I got to thinking about this was because a few weeks ago when I gave a talk, a question came up near the end. I was talking about all of our doings that have gone on here, particularly now in recent times. I was talking, if you remember, I talked about the Sorcerer's Apprentice. For those of you who might have been here, And I pointed out some of the dangers, you know, that we have created for ourselves. And that we may be creating for ourselves even now. With nanotechnology, you know, making little robots that can reproduce themselves and they can go around, move around through the environment, doing whatever it is they're programmed to do, making copies of themselves. This is something that could get out of hand. It's like a virus. Or there's many other kinds of dangers with the biological weapons that we have, the nuclear weapons. We want to create this nuclear shield that will, a missile shield here that will protect us from incoming missiles. All the while, we forget the guy who comes into town with a suitcase and releases some biological agent. All kinds of dangers here. Well, how do these things come about? I was talking about this a few weeks ago. And then somebody asked the question that, well, surely we need to do something. We need to, if we haven't been working on all these things to improve our lives with medicine and modern technology and whatever, we're living longer now, aren't we? And we're less prone to disease, etc. Well, sure, we can point to things like that. I asked the question, well, are we better off today? And Gary nodded his head and he thought we were better off today. And certainly in many ways we can point to ways in which we are better off today. I can't deny that. But if we really think that we're better off, that's once more, we're just grasping for some kind of an answer here that, yes, we're better off today. But are we better off today? I won't say that we're better off today, but I won't say that we're not better off today. We have just come through one of the most frightening centuries of that humankind has ever gone through. What with the kind of wars that we fought now, starting with World War I, the war to end all wars, as it was called. Of course, it didn't end all wars. It just continued on into World War II. And then we developed the bomb. And yet we think, well, we're better off. But I don't know that we can say that we're better off. To say that we are better off is to think that the story is over. And then we live happily ever after, kind of a idea. We have the story. It's very exciting, a lot of drama, very interesting. And then it ends with, and then they lived happily ever after. Of course, we call that a fairy tale. Because that is to take this arbitrary point in the story and just say, well, this is it. Now we freeze it here. This is how it is. It's happily ever after. But the story is never over in real life. There's just this ongoing change and flux and flow. And are we better off? Or are we worse off? Well, how can we say? No matter what you say here, we can say something there. And you say something there, and we say something here. And we go on and on like this. What the awakened want is to be awake, and that is basically they don't want to be deceived by what is going on here. And what is going on here doesn't stop. It doesn't cease. It isn't frozen. We can't label it. We can't grab hold of it in any way at all to say that, well, this is better than it was. This is worse than it was. We can't say. We only need to be awake. This guy I quoted here, Yisan, he's a very Kuaishan, is the name, Chinese Zen master. And a very interesting fellow. There's a lot of stories about him. But there's this other story again, he's talking with his disciple, Gyosan, who was one of his senior monks. And one time Yisan was talking to his monks, and he said, apparently it was winter time, and it was cold. And he just commented on, well, today the weather is cold. It's cold as it was a year ago at this time, and as it will be a year from now. And then he said, tell me what the days of the year are repeating. And He looked at Gyo-san, his senior monk, and Gyo-san just made a kind of a ritual gesture of respect, but said nothing. And Isan said, "I knew you couldn't say anything." Then he looked at Kyogen, one of his junior monks, and he said, "What about you?" And Kyogen said, "Well, I think I can say something about that. I'm very glad that the senior monk couldn't say anything," Isan interrupted. Well, I think this really says a lot about our condition here. What are we going to say about this ongoing cyclical existence? What is it that it's repeating? The moment we try to say something about this, the moment we try to say something about life or reality, with a mind that has put things into a frozen form, thinking, this is how it is, I'm going to say something about that. If you really believe that, if you really think that that is true, then that is to make the story frozen. It's to think that you can't have a happily ever after kind of ending here. That is the end. It is not to see the actual reality that we find ourselves in, which doesn't end. Well, it's only when we latch onto this or that, including ourselves, me, I, we contain ourselves here in some kind of conceptual form, and now we can see endings. And then when we see our own ending, we're a little worried about that. So we create another story, and we have different kinds of stories about how we might go on, or, well, no, that's it, it's all over, and what do I care, because I won't know anything, so what? But it's all a story, it's speculation. We don't pay attention to the fact that we seem to think we need to be reaching for something here to take hold of that will quiet the disturbance in our mind about the fact that we can't grasp this. We overlook the fact that you never have grasped it, even though you think you've taken hold of reality in some way or another, believing it is this or believing it is that. In fact, you haven't, and you never have. You never will. And what disturbs us in our mind is this deep desire to think that we have to do that. We don't catch this in ourselves. The awakened are those who have recognized this, and who realize that all they really need and want to want for nothing is just simply that, to be awake, to be here, to realize that all of this is already sustained. Why interfere, as Isan says? When we interfere, when we step in to all of this activity with an agenda, with some kind of program, some kind of issue here, we interfere. We interfere with the great unfolding of life. And then we create the bombs, and we create the this or that. We create things that end up undermining everything that it is that we're doing, when in fact, reality itself just goes on. In this cyclical, repeating existence with nothing that we can say about it. The great insight of the Buddha was this matter of stepping into the activity with an agenda, with a program, with an idea that it must go like this, or that I must create this situation, or I must have that. He saw that this is the solidification of an imaginary thing called an ego, the I, and it creates a different kind of activity in the world than we find naturally. It is activity that is coming out of the part, out of the little self, as opposed to the activity that is coming out of reality itself as a whole. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't act, because this is impossible. It is impossible for us not to act. We have to act, because this whole world is nothing but activity. Therefore, action is taken. We have no choice in the matter. Inaction is still action, because everything is acting. So the question now for the awakened then has shifted from initiating some kind of a activity or some kind of a program or straighten something out to attention to what actually is happening. what actually is taking place. I like the way that Bernard Glassman talked about this last night. He talks about bearing witness, stepping into a situation not knowing, and now bearing witness. This is what the awakened do. In every moment, we step into a new situation. But usually with our minds formed, our minds rigid, we got a plan here, and it's got to go like this. And it's okay to have a plan. That's okay. But in each moment, just keep your eyes open and be ready to see what's happening now. Because it keeps changing. And there's no way to grasp it. To the extent that we have grasped, we force an issue, it must go this way, we suffer. And we create all kinds of difficulty for ourselves. So the point is, in it, it's neither to act or not to act. When I talk about this, when I talk about, for example, the technology that we've created and how it can threaten us now, in fact, there's a possibility we could, as a species, wipe ourselves out, not just ourselves, but a large portion of life on this planet. These kinds of things have happened before in the history of the world, and there's no reason to think that they couldn't happen again, and that they couldn't happen at our own hands, or with creating biological weapons and who knows what. And why are we doing it? We're doing all of this out of our desire to control and to manipulate. That's coming first, when for the awakened, what comes first is simply to be awake and to see what is going on here, to realize that nothing is threatening. Nothing is vulnerable here. We create these situations ourselves, and we don't understand that. So Isan says, why? Why should I interfere? The way the universe operates, the way the world of nature operates, is out of the whole, out of totality. It doesn't come from any locality, any one point. It is the whole thing acting in concert with the whole, with itself. This is reality. This is how it works. For us, to the extent that we have separated ourselves from this reality as a whole, what we need to do and what the awakened do is just simply their concern, their primary concern is just to see how this is taking place, how this is operating, and to act in compliance with that, as opposed to acting as we habitually do out of our little self, out of our own egoistic desires, wants, fears, worries, obsessions. So this is a very big issue. It is what most characterizes the awakened and how it is that one who is awake differs from one who is not awake, who is caught up in their delusion. It's a very subtle point, a very gentle point, very quiet point. The implications of this and the understanding of this are total. There couldn't be a greater reorientation of your mind and understanding than to realize this very subtle point that I raised today. If you want to know what this enlightenment is, it is nothing more than that. To want only to be here, to be present, to see the insanity, the grasping nature of your own mind, and to not act out of that. To recognize that it doesn't mean to just sit here on your hands and never move. That is impossible. You have to move, you have to speak, you have to do something. But you can do it with that very mind I just spoke of. We need to be reminded of this. We need to come back to this. At some point, maybe we can wake up to this. And we wake up to this, not so much that we wake up to this, we wake up to our own folly, our own grasping nature. Well, any questions or comments? Yeah, Gary.
Could you say rather than what's important is to be awake, that what's important is being? The term awake seems to suggest some kind of action for a person to sense that what's important is to really be into just the fact of being instead of our compulsive need to prove ourselves. We're social animals and we need to do things like get medals. But a deep, full appreciation of just being.
Mm. I guess it depends on what we mean by this, but if we take being to mean existence or persistence from moment to moment that we exist, that is a way of, once again, seeing ourselves as a separate ego, as something separated off. It could be. If that's the case, then we have it, yes, because that's what actually is reality as a whole. But we have to understand at that point, we are no longer acting out of a sense of self, out of a sense of self and other. And now I got to do something about this other. I have to arrange it according to my likes. You know? Once again, that's our problem. The fact is that given what we have here in this world, that everything is constantly changing, nothing's holding still even for a moment, there is no being. We cannot find being. Being implies persistence. Nothing's persisting. You see, so...
Being
as an illusion. Yeah. And we're taken in by that illusion of being, of I. The Buddha spoke of this, is that if we can actually see, if we see the ceasing of the world as it has come to be in each moment, as he points out, he says the idea of existence doesn't occur to us. But of course, then our mind, very quickly, we jump to the other side. Well, then he must mean that there's no being, no non-existence. And the Buddha said, for anyone who can see with right wisdom the arising of the world as it has come to be, the idea of a non-existence doesn't occur. Isan said, why interfere? What is happening here is happening here. We don't need to take hold of it, because anything you take hold of is not it. Whether we take hold of being, that is not it. If we take hold of non-existence, that is not it. Eternalism or nihilism, being is a kind of eternalism, this persistence here. We take hold of that, and that's what we tend to think, that's what we tend to believe, because that's how we conceptualize. The conceptually constructed world that we immerse ourselves in or are taken in by, there seems to be persistence here in being here. But if we look very carefully, we realize that actually we don't find that. But if we think that, well, oh, there has to have been being here, existence here, but now there isn't any, then very quickly our mind jumps to the side where we think that there's, what, nothing? Well, we can't believe that there's nothing here. All I have to do is look. How can we say there's nothing here? Obviously, something's going on here. But there's just no persistence in it. See, and this seems like a very simple point, intellectually. It might not be that hard. Well, it might be a little tricky to try to get a hold of that. But if we look very carefully at what these words, these pointing words of the Buddha, what he's saying here, if we look very carefully, not at what he said or because he said it, but just look very carefully, but look at it as we actually live in each moment, we will see that this actually is what's going on here. And if we see it in that way, then we're spared. It doesn't mean that we can't act. It doesn't mean that we can't plan or think or believe or have concepts. But it does mean that we're not going to be deceived by that, taken in by that. What motivates us, what drives us, has all shifted and changed. The motive now has simply become to be awake from moment to moment and to deal with each situation fresh and new as it arises without a preformed idea, to step into it not knowing and bearing witness to what's actually taking place and taking it from there. But of course, this is something that's repeated in each instant. Listening to last night, he talked about how Dogen had mentioned that in each finger snap already, he was saying something like 184,000. I think it was more like 84,000. Being a scientist who worked on the Mars, he was probably thinking the speed of light is about 186,000. I don't know. But Dogen, I think it was 84, it was 83 or 84, 81,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. All of a sudden, 64,000 all just came to my mind right now. But it was a lower number. I don't remember myself exactly what it was. But it's fast. In other words, you have reincarnated, well, there's no you here, but 64,000 instances have occurred. New being, new existences, so to speak, in just a finger snap. Well, if we look at, and that's just a number thrown out there. Don't believe that. But what it is that these guys, Dogen was basing that actually on earlier teachings that go back to the time of the Buddha. But this idea that there's this continuous rebirth, this idea is even discovered now in modern physics, in which that time itself, which seems to be a real thing, is the word they will use is quantized. In other words, it comes in little packets. But these packets are very small. There's actually billions of these in each one of these Dharma moments that Dogen was speaking of. So they're very, very tiny little packets. But if we were to look at our actual experience from moment to moment, without getting into physical theory or anything, you can actually see that this is what's going on here, that this is how it has to be. It cannot be otherwise. And that there's no persisting from moment to moment, that these episodes of they're called Dharma, the original teaching of this was that these are Dharma moments. They're very brief, unimaginably brief. Even their idea of 64,000 in a finger snap is massive compared to what modern physics now says that we have. But they're very brief. But that this is the only way we can actually understand our experience. And what it then means is that in each instant we have, the entire universe, in effect, is reborn in each one of these Dharma moments. That there's nothing persisting, even for a moment. The complete birth and death of everything that has taken place here. Already, there are trillions of you, quadrillions perhaps by now, since you entered this room. Therefore, if that's the case, what you are we referring to? Which one? Again, this is another way of looking at this no self. But there's no being. If we look very carefully, you don't have to see it from the standpoint of a physicist, or because the Buddha said it, or Dogen said it. If you look very carefully at your experience, you will realize that this is how the experience is, how it goes on, what it consists of. And for the awakened, all they want to do is to stay with that, remember that, not get caught into the belief that we persist. We persist, then we die. Then we have an idea about rebirth, thinking in terms of big chunks, like, here I would, and I died, and I'll come back as something else. Another big chunk here. It's all this grasping like that. No, it's death and rebirth. You can't even get hold of them. It's ungraspable. This explains conscious experience. No. Understanding of the mind comes forth out of this realization about our experience. But this can be seen and known directly if you just look very carefully at what the experience of this moment is. Well, I didn't really want to get too sidetracked into that today. I'm sorry, but yeah, Dave.
My wife told me about someone who said, "Questions unite and answers divide."
That's a great observation, because once again, that answer, and that's the thing we have to notice, that the answer is a frozen thing. You have this one, and you have this one, and of course, some people might grab that one, other people grab this one, and then now we got grounds for fighting, squabbling, and who's right. And in fact, beyond a certain areas of practicality where we need answers to this or that, in terms of reality as a whole, and what life is all about, what it means, and awakening, and all of this, it's just a wrong game to be playing altogether. Because it's like we want an answer for reality. Like, what is reality? What's it, you know, what we're acting as, what we want to know is, what is it like? And all we have to do is look at this very carefully. You realize that, well, reality can't possibly be like anything. It has to be itself. If it's like something, then we're not talking about reality anymore. But of course, that thing, what's it like? You just look at that, and we can see how we're grasping. We're reaching for some conceptualized form, a model of reality that we can hold in our minds as an idea. The awakened, they don't do this. They understand what that's delusion. You say, oh, it's like this. No, it's not. It's not like anything. And we can see this. The fact is that we can also begin to realize that you don't need to grasp. You don't need to hold it in that way. You haven't yet. And look, we're here. And we're here again. Here we are. We're still here. And we've never grasped it. Notice that what it is that you are grasping, you believe this, well, I believe this, and I believe that. This is where we go after we die. Whatever it is you're holding here in terms of this is reality, this is how it is, this is what we should think, this is what... Notice a lot of other people don't think that. Notice that if you really ask yourself honestly, are you sure? In the back of your mind, you're quivering there. There's a lot of problems here with this. But also notice, you notice that you really don't need to do that? You don't need to do that. We think that we need to believe in something, to hold to something. No, we only need to see. Kathleen.
I thought that was a very interesting thing when the Dalai Lama was told about the legislator that wouldn't come to his talk and all the controversy that he had stirred up. And the Dalai Lama just smiled and said, there's lots of different opinions. And it truly seems to me to be an example of peace. It didn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, and all these people had just gotten all up in arms about it.
Right.
Yeah. And he just seemed to, in all his candid moments, just exhibit that ability mm-hmm. to just be right there and not
speaking. I think I just cut in on a news clip. I missed what happened before, but I suspect they were talking about that. And what I heard him saying was that you don't see things this way. And he says, of course you don't. People see things differently? Well, of course. Is this new? But the problem is that for each one of us, we hang on to what it is that we see. Our view. This is how, you know, and there's our problem. We should recognize, and Dalai Lama recognizes it, that you have a view. Of course we have a view, but if you hang on to it, there's your problem. Also, I think I heard that he had said something about... people are concerned about preserving, like the American Indian, you know, preserving their way of life as being destroyed and taken. And the Dalai Lama said, well, of course, it's going to, you know, you're going to lose it. You can't preserve it. You can't, I mean, he can say that. Difficult for us to say that. But given what's happened to his country and his culture, he can say that. But he also says it from the standpoint of just recognizing that nothing lasts. Everything is changing. And we can enjoy what was here. We can enjoy what's going. It has its own kind of beauty. But it's the clinging part that we, you know. Anything else? Maybe we've gone long enough here. Thank you.